Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 28, where we're joined by Mads Alvesen to discuss his GMS classic on organizations as rhetoric. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this picks up right where we left off. And now, back to the conversation.
So, I suppose to play devil's advocate a bit, is there really another option? Isn't rhetoric what we're all engaged in all the time? Can we step out of it?
Goffman has a point that we're also into creating impressions of who we are and what we do and so on. So in that sense, I mean, rhetoric is this key element of human life, and particularly perhaps the contemporary working life. There was a study by some American economists, and they estimated about 25 to 30% of the American workforce, North American U.S. workforce, they are into mainly into persuasion as the major activity. So more than a quarter of the workforce then could be called sweet talkers as a key element. And of course, within this entire group, you have people that give talks based on perhaps finding some good statements on Google, and then they have a nice performance, and then they talk about this for very appreciative audiences for a large amount of money. That's one extreme. There's extremely little kind of substance or knowledge or careful thinking or something like that behind that. And on the other hand, you have people that do quite serious research and really try to consider what established knowledge think through about issues, do ethnographic work and so on in the research context. So then you have like a spectrum of different types of basis for the various knowledge claims or the rhetoric. And of course, here's enormous variety, but also in the latter category, people that really try to spend enormous amount of time and energy and talent of having something important to say in terms of knowledge contribution. Of course, a large part of that work is to frame it in such a way so it becomes interesting and persuasive, etc. So also serious people working with knowledge there into rhetoric. But here I will say that there is a lot of work behind them, the impression management that is there. So in that sense, I think there's often a point in making a distinction between more hollow knowledge claims and something that is more carefully backed up, even if we have like the rhetoric is always being there, irrespective of what you do, because it's very seldom that your knowledge only speaks for itself. You need to have a lot of backup in terms of the presentation, in terms of getting attention, in terms of convincing people. Yes, this is a key point. This is worth paying attention to, and so on.
Well, isn't this largely a question of qualifying criteria? So, question of epistemology. What it is that we would qualify as knowledge depends on what are our qualifying metrics.
Well, I think we need to pay attention to, of course, what are the basis of the stuff people are claiming to be knowledge about, and so on. I mean, you also have a lot of different viewpoints on this. So, if you are very kind of radical social constructionist, then you wouldn't make any claims about what's behind a particular, like, text or statement or presentation or whatever. I think that become a bit too relativistic, and it's quite unhelpful. Although I agree that you can do interesting studies also here, where you look at the text, you look at knowledge claims, you look at how specific knowledge contributions or ideas about people's expertise or professionals or whatever, how they are backed up. So in that sense, we can also always decide that we look at the rhetoric or we look at the discourse and don't make any type of bold claims or what's behind that. For me, that's a bit too relativistic, and I think that we then easily contribute to a social world where people are not so inclined to make critical judgment about what is the value of this, should we have trust in this, what is like legitimation that makes sense, and what calls for the whip. So I think it's important to recognize the social construction, the constructed nature of everything, but not necessarily go for the more radical or relativist versions of.
So in the paper, you talk about something called institutional myths, and that these myths are basically a taken for granted beliefs that compensate for the absence of true rationality, and that this is one of the ways in which rhetoric helps keep actors anchored within their working environment and within stable within their knowledge claims. I think that's very interesting. Reflecting on my experience with being in organizations and doing studies of organizations, I found this notion of compensating for the absence of true rationality very resonant, because people that I observed or people that I worked with did not really, in general, concern themselves with figuring out whether their knowledge claims are true, internally consistent, or anything like that. It was just a taken for granted piece of information that would guide their actions and determine their agency. And this idea that these are myths and that they're institutional myths connected further outside of the organization as well as within, I think is a very good metaphor to kind of highlight the ambiguity and maybe in a sense meaninglessness of talking about knowledge as a you know, in a strong way anyway, as something that happens within organizations.
Yeah, no, I think that the concept of institutionalized myths, Mayer and Rowlands from 77, that's very kind of productive or interesting way of conceptualizing some phenomena. Concept is a bit vague, but I think it often makes sense to think about how people in organizations, they just adapt what seems to be there in terms of the practice and arrangement, the concept signifying something, and take this for granted and believes that it stands for rationality and reliability, and the use of this leads to productive effects when it's often, that is often not the case at all. So organizations, they are full of all this stuff and presumably more and more populated by professions, by departments, by practices and structures that signal compliance with these institutionalized myths, partly for legitimation reasons and partly, as I said before, for grandiosity reasons. So I make a distinction between, you have a lot of plans and HRM and quality control and knowledge management and leadership development and team building and rational planning and et cetera, partly in order to hear as good as everybody else, reasonably high level of legitimacy, but often it goes beyond that. So it's a lot of this, we are more excellent than others, we have more HRM, we have more executive development, branding kind of work is so impressive and blah, blah, blah. So there's a harsh competition here in terms of being more grandiose than others, and a lot of this grandiosity is about then the relationship to institute myths that people are not thinking through. It just take for granted, and I follow this quite uncritically, quite unreflexively. Prime example in many cases of what we call functional stupidity. It's rewarded. People around doesn't necessarily stand critical scrutiny. The people should start to think carefully and reflexively about all this. They should realize that a lot of stuff going on in organizations are quite meaningless, or at least debatable.
On one hand, this sounds a lot like a product of good collective memory, for lack of a better term, that coming back to this problem that individuals in organizations have in navigating ambiguity and how they draw upon these institutionalized myths and how they follow these knowledge claims that may or may not have any relevance to truth, if there is such a thing that is irrelevant for the time being. It seems that this habituation and routines and especially things you mentioned about material objects, buildings and documents and awards and all these identity perpetuating devices, that has to do with building up and maintaining and continuing a certain mnemonic property of organizations, and I don't know what you think about that, but certainly looking at the history of epistemology, memory, whether individual or, I suppose, to a lesser extent, collective, played an important part in understanding knowledge as such. So I guess thinking of maybe knowledge-intensive firms as these systems of beliefs and systems of symbols, maybe it's worth understanding them in a more continuous historical way and with regards to their particular means of understanding themselves in time as well as in space.
Not certain that I'm following you there, Dimitris, but okay, could you...
Well, in short, basically, that knowledge, I think it is difficult to understand knowledge as detached from either history or memory. If we're talking about history, it's more objective, of course, but I think memory would be a more appropriate term for our discussion because we're more concerned with rhetoric and meaning building and how individuals construct their knowledge environments. So what do you think is the importance of considering memory and looking at memory or other memory-like characteristics that groups of people may have with regards to understanding the knowledge that they're dealing with and what is the epistemological system that they're working with?
I haven't thought that much about this particular aspect, but the general problem is that memory tends to be a bit short sometimes. So knowledge is often connected to fashion. I mean, the idea, if you are a knowledge intensive firm, you're not supposed to use knowledge that is ancient. You should be on the edge. It should be something new. And this means that fashion orientation is quite significant in many cases. Of course, not for all knowledge-intensive firms or other workers, but there is this very strong tendency that one is inclined to go for the most novel, on the cutting edge, etc. And this often calls for bad memory, that one is not necessarily thinking through issues or in the long-term perspective, or is that interested in learning from previous experiences. So according to Robert Jackall, it's written the fantastically good book, Moral Mazes, in order to make a career in a company or for a company to have a competitive advantage, you should be able to jump on and jump off various types of fashions in terms of whatever.
That definitely.
Yeah, and this calls for some bad memory. And what's striking sometimes when you investigate organizations, that the real interest in learning, in becoming more insightful or really developing based on careful evaluation and learning of previous experiences, that's something that people are not necessarily so interested in. They jump on the new project with the hope that now things will become extremely much better, and then are very sensitive for new fashions. And of course, this calls for memory, the corporate memory being quite weak. And I think that in many cases, then this interest in what do we actually know, what have we learned from the past, etc., that poor memory is something that is a crucial aspect for a lot of companies. And this is actually often, in many cases, a competitive advantage. If you start to think about issues from the past, what we should have learned from previous experiences and so on, then you may maybe much... you may be in a worse situation when it comes to jumping on new stuff. You may be quite questioning when it comes to new projects, new ideas, new initiatives, etc. So in those cases, then you make life only more difficult for yourself and for your own company if you insist on memory. So just thinking about universities, working with strategies, it should be a new strategy every X number of years. And of course, this is easy to mobilize some enthusiasm if you are not thinking through what was the meaning or meaninglessness of this exercise previous time.
Well, that's one view of it. And I think this a view of memory as a learning of previous events. It's very consistent with this Aristotelian notion of knowledge, but what you said, especially about tendency of organizations to follow fashions, that's an equally valid understanding of it. And it's a fascinating thing that Niklas Luhmann conceptualized that memory is not a record of learning, but rather a function of how well organizations or groups of people preserve their existing state of belief. So the better groups of people, organizations reject new information, new paradigms, the stronger their memory is. And with that respect, looking at this fashion fetish within management and management practice, that would actually, in this way, in this really weird way, indicate very strong perpetuation of existing paradigms and their existing memory.
Demetrius, I was actually wondering there, do you see that perhaps organizations have this, what Christopher Gray calls the fetish of change, always wanting the new, but professions perhaps are more invested in that sense of collective memory? There seems to be quite a lot of rituals around reminding of founders of the field or, you know, important moments in the professional history that perhaps transcends the organizational boundaries. I don't know what you both think of that distinction.
I've certainly observed that in my studies, but I have studied very old, very established professions such as engineering and architecture, and I'm not sure what would be the case with our profession, for example. But I mean, we do record and to an extent cherish our history, but that might just be us in the podcast. because one of the reasons we started this is because no one reads the classics anymore. So actually, I think scratch that last bit. I don't know. I think it's. I tend to agree with Mats in that this is a system of rhetorical activities, and there is a lot to do with maintaining and clinging on to certain claims for legitimacy as a function of this weird organizational existential striving. But I think there is a lot of room for understanding this through the lens of memory, not history necessarily, but memory, which is a particular take on what has happened, what are the identities involved, and what it means to be a good professional, and all the other value claims that you actually touch upon in these papers, Mats, quite a lot.
This is something we should be much more interested in trying to support, investigate and think about what actually should we remember and how can we use this much more. My experience is that people are very much then jumping on the next project, much more forward looking, that most companies that are suffering from very bad memory. I read one study some time ago where after consultancy projects, there are almost never any kind of evaluation. You have consultants coming in, they do their work, and then you move on to the next project and the next use of consultancy, etc. But there's no really evaluation. And I think that this is one indicator of corporate memory being very kind of weak. And it's not something that necessarily, at least in a more systematic way, is being attended to. So of course, in many cases, you have like folklore, where you have stories, you have interest in historical events and so on. But in most companies, my impression is that corporate memory is quite weak, and a little effort to strengthen this, which I think is an enormous problem. This could be a bit of an antidote to people being too inclined then to just be following the rhetoric and be seduced by various new projects, new ideas, new leadership, strategy, fashions, whatever.
Do you think there's a correlation between this and the incredible amount of ambiguity that has to do with knowledge in these firms?
Well, if you have the ambiguities, people are uncertain, they don't know what to do exactly, and you have these norms where most people are not so inclined what you actually mean, what's the kind of point here, or what's the substance of all this. then you are so easily seduced by something that sounds really good and really impressive. In many cases, it's more or less the same, but it's a new label. People are disinclined to think through what does this actually mean, what is the likely outcome of all this. But you should be optimistic, you should be positive, you should be a person that is looking into the future, and you jump on the bandwagon and you produce an atmosphere that seems to be hopeful and create some kind of certainty. And in a world that often is uncertain and full of vagueness and incoherences and so on, I think that this kind of orientation then is often promoted, and people repress then doubt, keep it for themselves, and then move on with whatever suggests a brighter future to follow.
And these claims have very real effects. You mentioned Foucault's statement that knowledge creates the truth. And when these claims are made very persuasively, they do create truths. I mean, the example that springs to mind is McKinsey's introduction of the term talent and the war for talent in the late 90s. And that wasn't a concept prior. And if you look at just the amount of activity that's mobilized around the world, it's quite extraordinary. And now there is this war for talent. And so that truth has been produced in a very effective way, in that it has many effects.
No, you have, in terms of personal administration, it used to be called personal administration, and it was human resource management, and then strategic human resource management. But of course, people in HR, they've always been a bit questioned and felt that they're on the margins of corporate life. Here you have another possible solution. Increasing their status, position, doing something that is really good and contributing to the core of the business. And a lot of top management folks, they feel that others are into this talent management, and in order to not be left behind, but preferably be ahead of all others, then one spend a lot of some time and energy into doing this talent management. Of course, it's extremely vague and problematic concept. I mean, what is talent? Talent should be promoted, probably not still in most companies. Most work is quite routine, and if people are happy doing relatively routine work and not necessarily getting the peculiar idea that they belong to a talent mass that should have special treatment and privileges, and we should look forward to a fantastic career trajectory. Then if people would buy into this notion of talent, then they create a lot of problems for them. But still, this vague notion of talent, it's there, and then a lot of people are kind of jumping on this new possible fashion. Some people maybe single out, you have particular activities that are into talent management, and then you create some effects, probably rather contradictory and confusing, but there still are effects. Resources are being spent, people participate in seminars, they're exposed to whatever HR kind of practices in order to be singled out as talent and treated as such and so on. So it's part of corporate reality for better and, I would say, primarily for the worse.
So, Matt, we've talked a lot about knowledge, but what about stupidity? Does that have another counter role in organizations to counter all of this rhetoric around knowledge?
Yeah, and I think that the relationship between knowledge and stupidity is quite interesting. Of course, you have like pure stupidity in companies where people are just not thinking at all or producing different types of problems. But we've been quite interested in functional stupidity, which calls for some knowledge, or even considerable knowledge or expertise. Then people do the job in a quite technically competent way. So it's based on knowledge. But the problem with a lot of knowledge is that people become Fachidioten, you become professional idiots. You are quite narrow-minded. You take your expertise for granted. You address the world based on your own relatively narrow mindset as a particular specialist. In that sense, knowledge often stands in a dialectical relationship with functional stupidity. So particularly people are very specialized. They are not particularly reflective, not critically thinking in the broader sense of the world. And knowledge can actually be a source of what we call functional stupidity. And the problem is that contemporary organizations, they are full of specialists. They are not thinking more broadly about issues. And that means that organizations, they are full of various forms of narrow knowledges. And these are then fueling organizations characterized very much by functional stupidity. People thinking within their boxes, doing the things that they do in the right way, but not asking if they're doing the right thing or what's the overall meaningfulness of all this. And this is an interesting aspect around then knowledge and stupidity, where they are not opposites, but they are more dialectically intertwined. And we are addressing this, André Spicer and I, in our recent book, The Stupidity Paradox, The Power and Pitfalls of Functional Stupidity at Work.
Well, that definitely resonates with my own experience. I mean, there's all this rhetoric around knowledge and organizations wanting more knowledge, but if you've ever tried to question things in some organizations, you realize that that's not necessarily always the aim to constantly change and improve despite the rhetoric. So I think that we can all probably learn something from those stories, Matt.
No, I think we talk a lot about learning and development and reflection and open discussions and so on. In most cases, most of us are a bit more inclined to keep to our own small mindsets and reproduce and reinforce our own identities. And these are sometimes threatened if there are messages or ideas that cause for radical rethinking about what we are doing and what we spontaneously find to be really good and comfortable and so on.
So for those of our listeners who haven't read it, do check out Mats's new book on stupidity. It's a lovely, not very long read. Definitely would recommend having a look at that. Right, Mats, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you and to hear from you personally about this research that you've done and these ideas and what you think about them going forward.
Thanks so much for your interest and for this conversation. Very enjoyable for me as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mats.
And that's all for episode 28. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this discussion, and if you have, please share it with your friends, colleagues, and students. Also, check out Mats's book that he mentioned right there at the end, The Stupidity Paradox, by him and André Spicer. You can find a link to it on our episode page on the website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Next week, we're bringing you a summary of this episode, as per usual, and the week after that, we're bringing you the penultimate episode of this series, where we're joined by Denise Rousseau to discuss Herbert Simon's GMS classic on the business calls. It's a very fascinating episode, and really can't wait to bring that to you. Meanwhile, please get in touch with us on social media, subscribe to our newsletter, and of course, join us next week as we continue discussing the Journal of Management Studies classics here on Talking About Organizations.